From the Voice of America, this is Learning English Weekend. I'm Katie Weaver. It is a rainy Saturday, April 30th, in Washington, D.C. The weather is perfect for an Edgar Allan Poe story, and we've got it. Today, Shep O'Neill reads The Purloined Letter. Also later, Ashley Thompson and I tell you about another U.S. national park. But right now, we go to Christopher Jones Cruz for a new report about the state of media freedom around the world.
A new report says freedom of the press declined worldwide last year to its lowest point in more than 10 years. Freedom House, a group that supports freedom and democracy, said only one person in seven lives in a country where reporters' safety is guaranteed, and where media are not restricted or pressured by the government. The report says media freedom worldwide has declined for the past 12 years. Jennifer Dunham of Freedom House described several reasons for the decline.
One is the heightened level of violence against journalists around the world in various settings. And another primary reason is kind of the heightened level of polarization or partisanship in several different types of media environments.
Powerful media owners and armed militants pressure reporters to support political groups rather than to report objectively on all groups. And dictators and other anti-democratic political leaders are trying to stop independent reporting. The most dangerous subjects to write about include corruption, land development, religion, and crimes committed by organized groups. Ms. Dunham says reporting from areas where conflict or wars are taking place has become so dangerous and deadly that reporters struggle to get information from those places.
In Syria and Iraq, we do see just reporters having to risk their lives to get any type of news whatsoever. And, Syria was the place with the highest number of journalist deaths in 2015.
Reporters' lives are also endangered in nations with high crime rates. These nations include Mexico and some Central American countries where local officials are paid bribes by powerful groups of criminals that grow, sell, and transport illegal drugs. Freedom is also limited in cyberspace. Many countries limit access to websites that may report criticisms of their governments. And China has more reporters in prison than any other country. Officials there are also starting to examine more closely reporting on the economy and other subjects that were at one time considered safe to report on. Sarah Rapucci also works at Freedom House.
There's government bans on certain topics that journalists choose to override and choose to report on anyway, or choose to try to do investigative reporting in certain taboo subjects like corruption of influential people.
The Freedom House report says journalists throughout the world refuse to stop trying to get information and report about it, even though they face intimidation, danger, and even death. Russia is one of the countries that make life difficult for reporters. Russia often stops foreign reporters from entering areas it controls. Russia and other countries want people to know only their position on events, not the complete truth. Media experts say press freedoms in Russia have been weakened by President Vladimir Putin. They say his government has increased state ownership of and influence on media, and it has restricted reporting that is critical of the government. Most Russians learn about news events from television reports. The government has targeted television reporters. Most television stations are now completely controlled by the government. However, one station in the Russian capital, TV Rain, remains independent. The privately owned station is one of the few broadcasters in Russia that regularly reports criticisms of government policies. Natalia Shanatskaya reports the news on TV Rain.
We're not a politically motivated network. We don't really see it as our goal to, you know, to challenge the political establishment or anything like that. You know, we just try to be as objective as we can, and that's really what we're about.
Many of the employees of TV Rain decided to work there because it was independent of the government. Some of them left other television stations as the government increased its control. Shanatskaya is one of them.
Because I actually quit RT about a month before the Crimea events. I just had a feeling that things there were tightening in a very uncomfortable way. And as somebody who was there from the beginning, I found that disturbing.
But refusing to report only positive news about the government, like state media do, has hurt TV Rain. The station reported criticisms of Soviet military strategy during World War II. The government didn't like the story and pressured cable companies to drop the channel in 2014. Many people believe the government was looking for any reason to take action against the station. They include Ilya Klishin, the chief of digital media at TV Rain.
I sincerely believe that if it wasn't that story about like the siege of the Leningrad, they would find something else. Like it was just a matter of days or weeks.
In an attempt to survive, TV Rain began putting its programs online for people who paid a fee. 70,000 people now pay to see the programs, and its website gets millions of page views every month. But Klishin says TV Rain, like all Russian media, is being restricted by the government in what it can report. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Our national parks journey this week takes us to New Orleans, Louisiana, the city many consider to be the birthplace of jazz. New Orleans is a port city at the mouth of the Mississippi River. It holds one of the most famous cultural celebrations in America, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, called Jazz Fest for short. This year, the event opened April 22nd and continues through May 1st. It is the 47th festival. Famous performers this year include Stevie Wonder and Paul Simon. The first New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival took place in 1970. That year, about 350 people attended the five-day celebration. 5 years later, about 80,000 people attended the festival. Today, attendance is measured in hundreds of thousands. The festival's original organizers said the event could only be held in New Orleans, because here and here alone is the richest music tradition in America. And only in New Orleans could you find a whole national park honoring jazz. Today, we are exploring the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park.
The park includes sites important to jazz history in New Orleans. Visitors can walk around the city to see these sites. They include places located in the oldest part of the city, the French Quarter, as well as in the Louis Armstrong Park.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, here's one you all can sing with us when the Saints go marching in.
Louis Armstrong is one of the greatest American jazz musicians. His voice, trumpet playing skill, and creativity continue to influence jazz artists today. Armstrong was born in New Orleans in 1901. Jazz was just beginning to develop when Louis was a boy. It grew out of the blues songs and ragtime music that had been popular at the turn of the century. Louis Armstrong discovered music early in life. He was surrounded by it. By the time he was 18, he joined the Kid Ory Band, one of the finest bands in New Orleans. In the 1920s, Armstrong moved on to Chicago and then New York, which had become major centers of jazz music. The trumpeter soon became one of the most famous musicians of his time. In the 1930s, he had his own big band, called Louis Armstrong and His Orchestra. But his biggest hits came later in his life. In 1964, his version of the song Hello, Dolly was the top hit around the world, and the song What a Wonderful World, recorded in 1968, was his final big hit.
Red roses too, I see them blue.
Armstrong died in 1971. In 1980, the city of New Orleans opened the Louis Armstrong Park to honor one of the city's most famous sons. Among other sites, the park includes a statue of Armstrong himself and a place called Congo Square. Throughout history, the square has had many names. Congo Square was once used as an area where slaves were permitted to perform African and Caribbean dances and drumming. The sounds played a role in the development of jazz. Today, the city holds the annual Congo Square Rhythms Festival there.
Another stop within the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park is the J&M Recording Studio. It lies just south of the Louis Armstrong Park on Rampart Street. The studio operated from 1945 to 1955. Cosimo Matassa, a recording engineer, was the owner of the studio. He recorded some of the greatest jazz and rhythm and blues artists of the time. Today, the spot is a laundromat, but a small sign on the building points out its important place in music history.
Next, we visit the Mint. A mint is a place that produces coins. The Mint started out as a place where U.S. and Confederate currency was made. But today, the Mint has a famous performing arts center and a museum full of jazz history. That museum is the Louisiana State Museum. Here, visitors can see Louis Armstrong's first cornet, a brass instrument similar to a trumpet. He bought it in New Orleans when he was 15 years old. The National Park Service holds live educational performances at the Mint most days of the week. Many of those performances are streamed live online for viewers around the world to enjoy.
Another park site is Preservation Hall in the French Quarter. The word preservation means keeping or protecting for the future. By the early 1960s, traditional New Orleans jazz music was in danger of disappearing. Young people wanted to hear the music of Elvis Presley and other rock and roll stars. Not many young people were interested in listening to jazz. In 1961, Alan and Sandra Jaffe began using a small old building on St. Peter's Street as a music hall. Musicians there played traditional New Orleans jazz, sometimes just for their own enjoyment. Alan Jaffe was a tuba player. He played with what became known as the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. The Jaffes created Preservation Hall to protect and preserve the city's traditional jazz sounds. Today, different bands play at the hall each night. Musicians also still play in the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. They play in concert halls around the United States. They will even be playing on April 30th as part of this year's New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver. Edgar Allan Poe is best known for his horror stories. But the great American author also wrote crime mysteries. Today, Shep O'Neill reads us one, The Purloined Letter.
One evening in Paris, during the autumn of 1845, I went to visit a friend, Auguste Dupin. We were smoking our pipes and talking when the door of his apartment opened. Mr. Germain, the head of the Paris police force, came into the room. "I came to ask your advice," Germain said to my friend Dupin. "I'm trying to solve a very important case. It is also a very simple case, so I really need your help. But I thought you would like to hear about it, because it is so strange. My men and I have worked on this case for 3 months, Germain said. It is a very simple case of robbery, but we still cannot solve it. Dupin took the pipe out of his mouth.
Perhaps the mystery is too simple, he said.
Germain began to laugh. Too simple, he said. Who ever heard of such a thing? I looked at Germain.
Why don't you tell us the problem? I said.
Germain stopped laughing and sat down. All right, he said. But you must never tell anyone I told you this. The wife of a very important person needs help. I cannot tell you her name, because her husband is a powerful man in the French government. Let us just call her Madame X. 3 months ago, someone stole a letter from Madame X. She is offering a large amount of money to anyone who can return the letter to her. We know that her husband's political enemy, Mr. Darcy, stole the letter. We also know it is somewhere in his apartment. Darcy plans to use the letter to embarrass Madame X's husband and destroy his political power. As you know, I have keys which can open any lock in Paris. For the last 3 months, my man and I have spent every evening looking for the letter in his apartment, but we cannot find it. Dupin stopped smoking. "Tell me how you looked for it," he said. Germont moved forward in his chair. "We took our time," he said. "First, we examined the furniture in every room. We opened all the drawers. We looked under the rugs. We searched behind all the paintings on the walls. We opened every book. We removed the boards of the floor. We even took the tops off the tables to see if he had hidden the letter in the table legs. But we cannot find it. What do you advise me to do?" Dupin puffed on his pipe. "What does the letter look like?" he asked. "It is in a white envelope with a red stamp," Germont said. "The address is written in large black letters." Dupin puffed on his pipe again. "I advise you to go back and search the apartment again," he said. About 1 month later, Germont came back to see us. "I followed your advice," he said, "but I still have not found the letter." Dupin smiled. "I knew you would not find it," he said. Germont became very red in the face. "Then why did you make me search the apartment again?" he shouted. "My dear Germont," Dupin said, "let me tell you a little story. Do you remember the famous Dr. Louis Abernathy?" "No," Germont shouted. "Get to the point, Dupin." "Of course," Dupin said. "Once a rich old man met Abernathy at a party. The old man was not feeling very well. He decided he would get a medical opinion from the doctor without paying for it. So he described his problems to Abernathy. 'Now, doctor,' the old man said, 'suppose you had a patient like that. What would you tell him to take?' 'Oh, that is quite simple,' said Abernathy. 'I would tell him to take my advice.'" Germont looked embarrassed. "Look here, Dupin, I'm perfectly willing to pay for advice." Dupin smiled at Germont. "How much money did you say the reward was?" he asked. Germont sighed. "I do not want to tell you the exact amount, but I would give 50,000 francs to the person who helps me find that letter." "In that case," Dupin said, "take out your checkbook and write me a check for 50,000 francs. When you have signed the check, I will give you the letter." Germont looked at Dupin with his mouth open. His eyes seemed to jump out of his head. Then he took out his checkbook and pen and wrote a check for 50,000 francs. He gave it to Dupin. My friend examined the check carefully and put it in his pocket. Then he unlocked a drawer of his desk, took out the letter, and gave it to Germont. The policeman's hands shook as he opened the letter. He read it quickly, Then he put it in his pocket and ran out of the room without saying a word. "Dupin," I said, as I turned to my friend, "how did you solve the mystery?" "It was simple, my friend," he said. "Germain and his policemen could not find the letter because they did not try to understand the mind of the man who stole it. Instead, they looked for the letter where they would have hidden it. Mr. Darcy is not a policeman. He is, however, very intelligent. He knew the police would search his apartment. He also knew how police think, so he did not hide the letter where he knew they would look for it. Do you remember how Germain laughed when I said the mystery was difficult for him to solve because it was so simple?" Dupin filled his pipe with tobacco and lit it. "Well, the more I thought about it, the more I realized the police could not find the letter, because Darcy had not hidden it at all. So I went to visit Darcy in his apartment. I took a pair of dark green eyeglasses with me. I explained to him that I was having trouble with my eyes and needed to wear the dark glasses at all times. He believed me. The glasses permitted me to look around the apartment while I seemed only to be talking to him. I paid special attention to a large desk where there were a lot of papers and books. However, I saw nothing suspicious there. After a few minutes, however, I noticed a small shelf over the fireplace. A few postcards and a letter were lying on the shelf. The letter looked very old and dirty. As soon as I saw this letter, I decided it must be the one I was looking for. It must be, even though it was completely different from the one Germain had described. This letter had a large green stamp on it. The address was written in small letters, in blue ink. I memorized every detail of the letter while I talked to Darcy. Then, when he was not looking, I dropped one of my gloves on the floor under my chair. The next morning I stopped at his apartment to look for my glove. While we were talking, we heard people shouting in the street. Darcy went to the window and looked out. Quickly, I stepped to the shelf and put the letter in my pocket. Then I replaced it with a letter that looked exactly like it, which I had taken with me. I had made it the night before. The trouble in the street was caused by a man who had almost been run over by a horse and carriage. He was not hurt, and soon the crowd of people went away. When it was over, Darcy came away from the window. I said goodbye and left. The man who almost had an accident was one of my servants. I had paid him to create the incident. Dupin stopped talking to light his pipe. I did not understand. "But Dupin," I said, "why did you go to the trouble of replacing the letter? Why not just take it and leave?" Dupin smiled. "Darcy is a dangerous man," he said. "And he has many loyal servants. If I had taken the letter, I might never have left his apartment alive."
That's all the time we have today on Learning English Weekend. Christopher Jones-Cruz is back tomorrow with the Sunday edition. I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for joining me.